Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What Wall Street can tell us about the economy? Here's a hint, sometimes not all that much. What a difference a millimeter makes, and hot chilies and a warming planet on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, everybody, the 29th of April. Good, as always, to have you with us. We closed the trading books on the month of April with the Dow Jones Industrial Average at three-year highs. But that bit of market trivia comes with a caveat, because when it comes to the economy that people actually live in, Wall Street doesn't always know what it's talking about. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Okay, maybe it sounds too simple, but all you really need to know about what the stock market has in common with the real economy, you might have learned on Sesame Street. So let's play One of These Things is Not Like the Other. Over here, the stock market enjoying a brisk recovery. Compare that to unemployment, still too high. Housing prices still sliding, and the greenbacks in your wallet losing purchasing power. Strangely, one of the things that's hurting consumers, the sagging value of our currency, is actually giving stocks a leg up. I reached Ted Weisberg of Seaport Securities on the trading floor today.
The very weak dollar is actually beneficial to corporate America selling products offshore, if you will, the emerging markets, where there has been a lot more growth than we are experiencing here in the U.S.
Economist Joel Naroff also points out that all those American workers companies dumped from the payrolls at the same time the rest of us were told to pedal faster, that's allowed companies to produce more with less.
Limiting job growth is a mechanism to increase earnings, and that improves the stock market, but it doesn't improve job growth.
Dean Baker at Washington's Center for Economic and Policy Research says those painful pump prices are also filling Wall Street's tank.
Exxon Mobil and the other big oil companies get higher profit margins. So a lot of what we might think of as bad for ordinary people can be good for corporate America. They're getting more money.
And he doesn't see an end to this cycle.
Firms have told us, and they're right, they're not going to go out and invest a huge amount if there's not demand for it. So we could be in for a very long slump.
Which is one more reason stocks are rising. There just aren't very many other options for growing our nest eggs, so we're still putting our money in the market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's been about a year since Arizona passed its controversial immigration bill. Although key parts of it are still tied up in court, other states have followed their lead. The governor of Georgia is set to sign a tough new immigration bill. But today, the tourism industry made one last-ditch effort to kill it off. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the story.
The Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau today publicly opposed a Georgia bill that would give police more authority to question people about immigration status. The legislation is similar to Arizona's law, but not as broad. Ron Fennell is with the Georgia Hotel and Lodging Association.
It's focused only on criminal activity. It doesn't include county and municipal type violations.
Like trespassing or traffic violations. Fennell hopes the immigration debate doesn't keep tourists away. They come from around the world and bring about $10 billion to the local economy each year. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal was asked today if the potential for an economic backlash gives him pause.
No, my commitment is to sign the legislation. I think this legislation was crafted to try to make sure we did not infringe on the civil rights of anyone who is lawfully in this country.
Though the governor says he'll sign the bill into law in the next 2 weeks, immigrant rights groups are planning to protest at the Capitol this Sunday. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It can fairly be said that there's almost no news about Apple that is too small to notice. And by small here, I actually mean physically small. The shiny new white iPhone 4 took 10 months to deliver, but now has set the tech press ablaze because, well, because it's white, right? Shocking. But it's also 2/10 of a millimeter fatter than the black one is. Does size matter? Normally, no, but because it's Apple, it does. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Is a fuller figured iPhone really such a bad thing? 2/10 of a millimeter might not matter much to you, but Renee Ritchie at the iPhone blog says if your business is designing cases for the iPhone 4, it could mean the difference between having a hit on your hands and having a problem. Well, kinda.
Some of them are a little bit too tight. They just feel a little bit like you're just pushing to get it in there, but they still work.
Industry analyst Jack Plunkett says, actually, as is the case with almost everything Apple touches, the financial stakes here are high.
Definitely a lot of money when you consider the fact there were roughly 50 million iPhones sold last year worldwide. And personally, I don't recall ever seeing an iPhone in someone's hand without a cover on it.
Not everyone in the industry is convinced there will be a big market for white iPhone cases. As our own John Moe of Marketplace Tech Report said on his blog today, if you're such an attention-seeking diva, you need a white iPhone, you're probably not going to buy a case anyway. In Silly Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Apple did fine in the markets today. Microsoft got creamed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our weekly wrap this Friday is more Washington than Wall Street. So Sudeep Reddy is here from the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. Also, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News down in Washington. Good to have you both back, guys.
Great to be with you guys.
Thanks.
All right, you guys watch the wedding?
Of course I watched the wedding. Are you kidding?
I had to know. Sudeep?
Yeah, everybody watched
the
wedding.
I did too, even though I protested
Sudeep
a lot.
Sudeep liked the hats.
But we will go to, let's call it American royalty, right? Ben Bernanke, big press conference this week. Did he do what he was setting out to do, Lizzie? I mean, first of all, what do you think he was setting out to do?
I think he was setting out, maybe this is too cynical, but not to screw up. I mean, look, you don't hear the chairman of the Fed speak. He doesn't do that. They do it in England. But the point was to not freak out markets, and markets, by and large, were not freaked out. I don't know if they got all the answers they wanted, but he didn't screw up.
Well, about the substance, though, Sudeep, did he say anything that, A, we didn't know, and B, sheds light on his inner soul?
He didn't really break ground for investors in telling them where the Fed is going to be going that much differently than we've known in the past. But he actually did help in pulling back the curtain and showing how the Fed operates, how the Fed thinks about these problems. And that's really useful for people, whether they're regular Americans or investors, who think the Fed has these mysterious powers to deal with all the ills in the economy. And he could really show that that's not the case.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say mysterious powers, because Lizzie basically said, listen, I can't fix gas prices. I'm doing everything I can on jobs and interest rates. And, you know, we're trying.
Yeah, he said we're trying. And maybe it's something that most Americans don't know. And I think some of the reporters pointed this out, is that the Fed, they don't really look at gas prices and food prices in their preferred measure of inflation. They look at core inflation, even though that's not what people feel most painfully every day. Maybe that explains it a little bit.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to use this opportunity to rectify a mistake that I made yesterday. I got yelled at it by listeners overnight in the email basket. I didn't mention GDP yesterday and how disappointing it was, even though Bernanke did talk about it on Wednesday. 1.8% in the quarter, Sudeep. Disappointing number.
It was a disappointing number, and we've had other disappointing numbers when it comes to jobless claims. Other figures are also showing some softness. And after a financial crisis, we all know that recoveries are going to be slower, and they're not going to go in a straight line. And so we just have to prepare ourselves for that. And hopefully we'll be picking up, but there are a lot of threats on the horizon, from gas prices to global instability, and all of this is going to be a problem for us.
Speaking of things pick up for you guys next week. Congress comes back to town. I'm sure there are many hosannas from Washington reporters. Now you guys have something to do. Lizzie, what are we going to see? What's going to happen?
Well, we're going to see a lot of rhetoric about the debt ceiling. There's been so much back and forth about whether this is really Armageddon, whether we are really in uncharted territory. If you go back to sort of the mid-2000s, there were a couple of times where we came within 15, 25 million bucks of hitting the debt ceiling. But people kind of knew what was going to happen then. And the underlying fiscal condition of the country was in more sound shape.
Sudeep, what do you think? What's Congress going to be doing?
That is exactly what they'll be doing, is talking a lot more. We do have a couple of more months to get to the point where we actually hit Armageddon and everything starts breaking down. But these first few weeks are actually really important to get a sense of the tone, whether everyone's going to really maintain their political posturing or try to come to some kind of a solution to dealing with this problem. There have been enough warnings about what will happen. So we know that a big problem could come, and this is a chance for lawmakers to show that there are adults in the room.
And they're starting to put out little teeny inklings that you might see, instead of one big vote, a couple of little ones, which would buy Congress a little time, might buy the Treasury some breathing room, and would actually, from a political point of view, make people be on the record with their votes.
Yeah, yeah. All right, before we go, most important question of the day. I need a yes or no answer. Lizzie, did you like the dress?
Yes.
Sudeep?
Who didn't like the dress?
Oh, well, I didn't. I didn't like the lacy stuff on top. I didn't like that. But that's just me. All right, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg. I know, but I mean, the setting was lovely. I didn't like the dress. Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Guys, we'll see you later.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
This has been a worse year than usual for bookstores. Borders has gone bankrupt. It's closing hundreds of stores. More books are being sold in their electronic editions as well. But here's something else to consider. Last September, nearly 200,000 people descended on Decatur, Georgia, outside Atlanta, for a book festival. In November, 500,000 people went to the Miami Book Fair. This weekend, 150,000 are expected to turn out here in Los Angeles for the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. Jennifer Collins reports now on how it is that book festivals thrive in an age when fewer and fewer physical books are around.
First, let's clear up this whole nobody reads in LA thing.
The popular myth is that the relentless sun so bakes the brains of its inhabitants that they can only think about getting a tan.
Steve Wasserman is a literary agent with Nerum & Williams.
In truth, some of the most popular and literate books are to be found in the hands of people in Los Angeles reading round the clock.
Wasserman should know. He was the LA Times book review editor for 9 years and oversaw the festival as its attendance doubled. Now it brings in over $1 million a year from sponsors and exhibitors. And Wasserman says with chains like Borders and Barnes & Noble closing stores, festivals have become a big opportunity for booksellers to connect with readers. Anna Magzanian is in charge of the festival for the LA Times. She says the event also turns to Hollywood star power to attract a larger audience.
We like the celebrity turnout as we feel like that is a draw for some of our folks to attend.
This year, the lineup includes The Office's Rainn Wilson, Jamie Lee Curtis, Ted Danson, and Patti Smith. You may remember her for this. Smith also won the National Book Award in November for her memoir, Just Kids. The festival is moving across town this year from L.A.'s affluent West Side. Magzanian says that'll give it more room to grow and put it closer to L.A.'s trendy young neighborhoods on the East Side.
We definitely want the hipsters there. It's a desirable audience for us, for them to engage with our brand, as well as for our exhibitors and our sponsors, et cetera.
I hate the categorization of East Side hipsters.
Marissa Gluck is with Radar Research. Okay, she's a bit of a hipster herself, but she admits this is the next generation of readers.
These are the people that are really engaged with social media and very likely to share. They're the bloggers, the writers, the tweeters. So, you know, I think that they're probably just chasing the cool.
And one place to find it is Skylight, an independent bookstore in Los Feliz, one of L.A.'s, yes, hipster neighborhoods. Several book clubs regularly meet here.
Like the freaking fish story, man. Oh, I just have this like, ah, oh, that is so good.
There's so much of that in this book. There's so much regret and like, I didn't make it or I didn't fulfill myself.
Emily Pullen and Melissa Bolton Klinger are discussing A Visit from the Goon Squad, the recent Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction by author Jennifer Egan. Pullen does the ordering at Skylight and says the festival and other outside events help keep her store in business.
It puts readers and authors and bookstores all in the same place. And that's something that, you know, no matter how cheaply online retailers sell books for, they aren't going to put you in the same room with an author who you admire.
And sometimes the festival is referred to as Christmas in April.
I have bookseller friends all over the country who are totally jealous of the LA Festival of Books.
Skylight's booth regularly brings in a week's worth of sales in 2 days. In Los Angeles, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, a story in which I learned the hard way about climate change and chili peppers.
It's not that hot. Fading already. Yeah. Except once it hits the back of your throat. That is a little odd.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials had another good day today, rose 47 points, about a third of 1%, closed to 12,810. The NASDAQ edged up a point, a fraction of 1%, 2873. The number of the S&P 500 put on 3 points, about a quarter percent, ended things at 1363. For the week, the Dow rose 2.4%, the NASDAQ climbed 1.9%, the S&P 500 gained 2%. Caterpillar moved the markets today with better-than-expected earnings. It scooped up 2.5% in the gain category. Goodyear rolled up 12%. Ancestry.com connected for a 42% gain. Seems the family history business is way exceeding analyst expectations. Microsoft deleted 3% today due to a drop in sales of its Windows operating system. Research in Motion, the parent company of BlackBerry, dialed down 14% today. Bond prices climbed. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.29%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for the month of March. Space Shuttle Endeavour is counting down to Monday, the next possible launch date for its final voyage. Today's launch was scrubbed due to mechanical issues. And soccer player David Beckham turns 36. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Congress has about 2 weeks left to figure out what it wants to do about the debt limit. It's going to be, as Lizzie and Sadeep said, topic number one when Congress gets back to town. Neel Kashkari is a managing director at PIMCO now, the big bond firm, but he has spent time at Goldman Sachs and more publicly in the Treasury Department, running the TARP for Henry Paulson. So we called him up to get a sense of the market's view of the debt limit debate. Neel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
How much tolerance do you think the market has for all this debt ceiling shenanigans?
I think the market has a fair bit of tolerance. I think that there's an important distinction between when the government reaches the debt limit and when the government would actually stop paying interest on the debt or actually default on the debt. Stopping paying interest or defaulting would be catastrophic for financial markets and for our economy. Reaching the debt limit would put some constraints on Treasury and make them make choices on where they spent the money that they did have, but the two are different. And it's not a catastrophe when we reach the debt limit.
It's a perception thing as much as anything else, right?
In part, the Treasury market and the dollar depend on investors having the perception that the U.S. government is going to do the right thing, that we're going to get our fiscal house in order, that we're not going to continue to spend much more money than we generate. And so ultimately, it comes down to confidence. We don't have that confidence yet. And the debt ceiling is becoming a litmus test for whether or not politicians can actually come together and make hard choices.
How are we going to know when the market has said, you know what, United States, we're done?
You know, that's a very hard question. I'm asked that a lot. How much time do we have? And it's impossible to know because investors around the world can decide we want to invest in America, we want to invest in Europe, we want to invest in Asia or in emerging economies. And so our relative position compared to these other markets is also very important. If Europe gets its house in order more quickly than America, then Europe could become a more attractive place for capital, and investors could change and decide to take money out of America and put it into Europe. So we don't know exactly how much time we have, but there are market indicators that we're watching very closely.
Well, what are some of those indicators then?
Federal government debt to GDP, so how much debt we have relative to the size of the country, that's very high now and climbing. Another indicator is the dollar, you know, relative to the euro, relative to the yen. The dollar's under more and more weakness. Another indicator is long-term inflation expectations, and those are also climbing.
But if you look at the bond market, right, you can go to the Treasury and get a 10-year T-note and pay like 3.5% interest, which by any measure is quite reasonable and shows no sign of these bond vigilantes, you know, the bond market slamming it shut and saying, we're not doing this anymore.
Yes, but that's a false indicator because the Federal Reserve has been buying about 85% of the Treasury issuance, and the Federal Reserve is not a cost-sensitive buyer. They're buying it at almost any price. And so we can't take much comfort from the prices of treasuries today because there's an artificial buyer. And so what we at PIMCO are very focused on is what happens to the treasury market when that artificial buyer goes away. And we think treasury prices are going to fall when that giant buyer goes away.
How much damage have we done merely by the fact that we have to have this debate about the debt ceiling and we can't figure it out?
You know, honestly, I don't think much lasting damage. On the other hand, I think it's a good thing that we're talking about the deficit. I think there's a lot of noise and bluster around the debt limit. But to the extent that it is a catalyst for us to get serious about controlling our deficit spending, I think net-net is a good thing.
So full faith and credit is still there. It's just get the spending under control.
Absolutely.
Neil Kashkari of PIMCO, the Bond Management Fund down in Orange County, California, lately of Goldman Sachs and also the Treasury Department, where you're in the TARP. Neil, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Take a moment now to consider the chili pepper. There are more than 10,000 varieties of them. We eat them. We season our food with them. They go into arthritis creams and shampoos, pesticides, and, yes, pepper sprays. In 2007, the last year we have the data for, American farmers grew more than 800,000 tons of chili peppers, 26 million tons worldwide, half of that in China. So needless to say, they're big business. Beyond the commercial, though, chili peppers are important in cuisines and cultures all over the world, which helps explain why I found myself shopping for chilies in a Mexican market the other day with a chef.
I'm Kurt Fries. I'm the chef.
And an agroecologist.
Hi, I'm Craig Kraft. I'm the agroecologist.
Yeah, what? Let me just say he knows more about chilies than you and I would ever want to know.
There are five domesticated chili peppers. Tabasco's one, habanero's the other one, and the rest fall under Capsicum annuum, all of these, your bell peppers, pasillas, your jalapenos, bells, wax.
It's habaneros and bells for us today. Paprika, too. That's a dried chili. Chef Kurt explains that our lunch menu is from St. Augustine, Florida.
Perlo, or most of us who live outside of St. Augustine would probably pronounce it Pilau. But we got roundly castigated, Craig and I, when we first arrived there and called it Pilau, and everybody knew we were Yankees.
However you pronounce it, it's a rice dish, a little bit like paella.
All different sorts of meats are possible, although chicken or shrimp are the most common ones in St. Augustine.
St. Augustine was one stop on a North American tour that Kurt and Craig did, a year on the road that took them as far as Sonora, Mexico, and Avery Island, Louisiana, home of Tabasco, for their book Chasing Chilies. It's part food guide, part thesis, what climate change is doing to chili harvest and how that's going to change the meals we eat. It's an allegory, Craig says, for the rest of the food system.
By picking chili peppers, we wanted to pick something that would resonate, and excuse the hoary pun, but something that would kind of light a fire in people's bellies.
So later that afternoon, back at my house, we lit a match for the old stove in my kitchen. We peeled and deveined some shrimp for a stock.
Oh, look at this. So you're actually splitting them, though. That's the easy way to
do it. Yeah.
We chopped up a bunch of habanero peppers. I took the obligatory taste test.
It's a nice crunchy pepper. It's not so bad.
It's not that hot.
It's not that hot. Fading already. Except once it hits the back of your throat. That is a little hot.
The pain, I should say, fades pretty fast.
No, I'm good. I'm all right.
And while Kurt sautéed shrimp and peppers in the background, Craig and I got to talking.
So what's happening to peppers as we have this climate uncertainty?
The ones we look at in the book, they're endemic to certain regions. You've got the chiltepín in southern Arizona, northern Mexico. Climate change, it affects the range in which these chilies can grow. When we were in Sonora, we were looking for the chiltepín in various people's homes, but there was a scarcity due to drought in the region, and no one had any chiltepins to sell for this year.
Which means people have to substitute something else for the missing chilies. And that something else might not be as good, or at least not quite right.
They cannot make the sauces and foods that their mother used to make, that their grandmother used to make.
You guys tell a story about you went down to Louisiana and talked to the McElhenney folks at the Tabasco factory. And they are doing, I mean, you might call it a little biodiversity, right? And getting away from those zones where climate change might impact their ability to stay in business.
They've had a few near misses. I believe it was Hurricane Rita. The floodwaters came to the foot of their factory. And so for them, it's a business proposition, right? They minimize their risk to their industry and their livelihoods by making sure they don't have all of their peppers in one basket.
If you will.
If you will.
Now, he said, Tabasco grows seeds all over Latin America. Kurt finishes up the sauté. He puts the shrimp and peppers in with the rice, spoons on some broth.
Excellent.
I'm going to bring this up to a good simmer and turn it down and cover it up. And in about 20 minutes or so, we should have us a rendition of Perlo.
Of course, there's a cocktail, too. You whisk up some simple syrup with sliced habanero and fresh ginger. You add rum to taste. I'll tell you, it was delicious, the drink and the meal, but it wouldn't have been the same without any of the heat. If you want to make the cocktail or the Perlo, check our website. We've got the recipes and some pictures there as well, and the first chapter of Chasing Chilies, too. Marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, wherein I promise never ever to complain about gas prices. Again, the Honolulu Star-Advertiser reports today on a station in Hana, Maui, charging $6.03 a gallon for regular. $6.03 a gallon. Premium, $6.25. Yes, gas is always expensive in Hawaii, but still, come on, man. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Friday. Today, the Dow gained 47 points, about a 3rd percent. The NASDAQ edged up a point, a fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 put on 3 points, a 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Yore. Coming up this weekend on a special edition of Marketplace Money, all that goes into owning a car.
You know, all the car care products, all the stuff that you end up doing, it ends up being just part of the fun of having it.
Yeah, all the paying for it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.